You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
And it's time to listen to Community Connections again, and this is the first one for the year. On the second Wednesday of every month, we've got our team come in from Hutchinson Legal, and we talk all things legal matter for the next hour. So we have with us Jason, who's a partner down there, and amen. Welcome, gentlemen.
Good morning. How are you, Alan?
Say it again. We didn't quite get there.
Good morning.
Well, it's afternoon, but anyway, let's not be picky.
No.
We had a great session running into Christmas last year with Grant, and we were talking about, you know, if children get swapped by mistake, or babies get swapped in mistake at the hospital. So now, from that, we've had a number of calls from people. We don't always want to get into family law, and we can't talk about a particular case.
Correct.
But we're only going to talk generally, and that's what we're all about.
That's right.
The question was brought to us that a child was about, there was a relationship, I don't know whether they were married or what, but they were certainly together, and a relationship broke down and they separated. Been separated for quite a number of years. Little guy, and it was a boy, gets to about 13, 14. I'm not sure what happened, whether there was an accident they had to do, but they had to do some DNA testing for some reason.
Sure.
Now, it proved that the father was 98% not father.
Yeah.
Because you can't say 100%. Now, he's pretty dirty about this.
Understandably.
He's been paying all these payments over a long period of time.
Yes.
He's so annoyed, he wants to try and get the money back. Yes. A, does he have any right to? B, how would you go about it?
Yeah, certainly. The short answer is that it'd be very, very difficult for him to do. The child support rules provide that there can be refunds of child support if you've got a question, if you've got a doubt, you raise a particular concern. So you raise your red flag, then you keep paying, and they'll refund back to the point of the red flag if you've raised that red flag in the formal way.
So if this person had, say they're raising their flag now, the child's 14.
Yeah.
They could only claim back to 14. They
That's
can't
the
claim
general
right
rule.
Back.
That's right. That's right. Now, there are some circumstances where if the mother knew about this and she'd intentionally perpetrated a fraud on him by telling him he was the father and inducing him to sign the birth certificate and so forth, there might be some extenuating grounds there which would allow you to go further back.
Would that be classified? Like, could she be charged? I'm not having a go at the women here, but I mean, we're not talking emotion here. We're talking about laws.
Correct, yes.
Would it be seen to be, could the woman be charged with fraud?
I'd have to take that as a question on notice, Alan. I don't know that you'd get across the line of a criminal offence of fraud. Right. But potentially it's a civil matter that might well be the case. Of course, the practical reality, and this is where the rubber hits the road.
Yep.
Unfortunately, the reality of trying to recover 14 years worth of child support payments at, you know, $100 a week or whatever it might have been, if you're talking thousands of dollars, the reality of trying to get that back from a single mother who's accepted it wrongfully is very remote. Would be very difficult to actually enforce anything, even if you're able to get a judgment that said you're entitled to the money back. So
you could be throwing good money after bad, couldn't you?
Exactly, and that would almost certainly be what would end up happening.
All right, well, that's terrific. We've got another case that we're going to give to you right at the end.
We'll look forward to it. They're always juicy and curly and good fun.
You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Community Connections on Yarra Valley FM 99.1, where it's 19 minutes past 12 and 23 degrees. And I have the team from Hutchinson Legal here. And a topic that's come up quite a bit because of the bushfires is the tree removal. What are you allowed to remove? What aren't you allowed to remove? Go for it.
Well, people normally think that the general thumb rule is 10 to 30 rule, which is 10 meters from your house and 30 meters away from your house if it's 10 meters high, the tree. But it all depends on the council and the zonings, especially at the overlays. If they are protected like a heritage tree or by the vegetation protection overlays. So the thing is, you just have to confirm with your council if you can remove it, because you would need a permit to remove your trees.
So you need to consult with the council before you start to pull trees down, don't you?
Yes, you do. Yeah, but you can apply.
It's a really good idea. There's a lot of information available on council websites. It's a great place to start and have a look, because there, as Aman said, there are the bushfire protections which allow clearing. As a general rule, you can remove trees within 10 metres of your house. You can remove all foliage and vegetation within 30 metres of your house. In some areas, that goes up to 50 metres. So it's about knowing exactly which rules apply to you. But it's worth investigating and inquiring. There are different rules for native trees, for protected trees.
Oh,
yeah, they can...
And I guess particularly up in the Dandenongs, I mean, some of these houses are almost on the, got the trees almost. In fact, someone was saying the other day his house would be indefensible. He said, yes, there's so many trees so close.
Yeah, correct.
So, I mean, people really have to, well, they've got to try and clear some of it too, don't they?
Exactly. You know? And do everything you can sensibly. Sometimes there are situations where you need to go back to council. Sometimes the initial advice might not be practical or reasonable in your circumstances. And sometimes you've got to push a little further past the initial response, the initial application to council, because you're the one who's living there. It can be a matter of, well, as we've seen, sadly, it can be a matter of life and death. Yeah,
absolutely.
Very serious.
And when we're talking about tree removal, what do you know what council declare as a tree? I mean, a fern, does that class as a tree, or
I'm afraid my specific knowledge of varieties and species is weak. They do have some criteria that relate to the measurements of the trunk, the diameter and circumference of the trunk, and also the height. And so that can be one of the triggers in whether you're allowed to remove a tree or not.
What about the shrub, you know, where it's just a spindly little thing, would you need a permit for that? Because you can prune shrubs, do whatever you like normally.
Generally, you can. I'm not too sure, Alan. You've stumped
me. Better not give advice.
Yeah, I'm not going to make it up. whether you can go scorched earth on all the shrubs in the backyard or not, I don't think you can, because there are specific provisions which allow you to clear shrubbery within the specific radius.
Yeah. And I don't know, and you're probably not the right person to ask. I do believe that there's other rules for ferns too, I think.
Yes.
Yeah, because you can't take ferns out of
there are licensing
out the hills, can
provisions.
You? There are a lot of rules around
that's
ferns.
That's exactly right. I remember a few years ago they had issues of people entering national forests, state forests, and illegally removing them because of the value. And I think if you go to a reputable garden centre, they all have license tags and tracking numbers to show that they are of legitimate provenance.
Yeah, I've got a son that's got couple in around his property, and one just fell over, like, because that some of these ferns haven't got much in the way of root structure.
Correct,
at all.
Yes.
And this thing fell over, and I was dead scared to take the tip. I thought, if I get caught doing this, and yet it just fell over.
Yes,
it was just must have got old, and their roots are so little, and if they grow up tall, you only get a bit of wind, and over they go.
That's right.
You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Yarra Valley FM 99.1, the voice of the valley, where it's 29 minutes to 1, 23 degrees, and I have the boy, or boys, that's going a bit much, the guys from Hutchison Legal with me, and they're going to tell us a bit about the swimming pool registration, rules of change, and you need to get your pool up to scratch.
Yes, Alan, just beginning from 1st of December of last year, now it's a requirement that you have all your pools and spas registered with your relevant councils, and these need to be registered by 1st June of this year.
Time's running out, isn't it?
Well, it is, because apparently there are quite a bit of pools in Victoria, about 200k or more. And since it's just a six-month period that you have to get into, you better be starting to...
And this doesn't only apply to new pools, does it?
No, it applies to all pools. Existing pools even applies to those which are above the ground, indoor pools.
Oh, like, even above the ground?
Yes, even above the ground. Like, well, literally all pools and spas. Nothing is exempted.
Oh, right.
Basically, yeah. The definition they're using, Alan, is anything that holds 30 centimetres of water. It can be considered as a pool. And so where this is significant, I mean, obviously there have been rules around fencing pools for years, and rightly so. But they're really expanding this. And you think of any accidental death in a pool is really an avoidable tragedy.
It's children, isn't it?
Exactly right. Mm. And so part of this is not just the registration of pools and spas. So it could just be a hot tub on the back veranda. That counts. And so now you've got to have that registered. You've got to have appropriate fencing, and it has to be registered. And so this is a new development where proactively you have to arrange a building inspector or licensed pool inspector to come to the property, have a look at it, tick off on it. Not just when on the initial registration, but then subsequently every 4 years, they're going to come out and make sure the fences
even
are still up.
Even if your pool's on the veranda, you're still not your pool. the spa is on the veranda. Yes. That still has to be inspected every 4 years.
Correct. So this is really quite new, and it's going to be huge. People in the industry have been talking about the fact that there are just not that many inspectors to do all these inspections. It's an entirely new requirement and a new field. Yep. But it is something that's coming in. So we would encourage listeners to jump in early. Because come late May, there's going to be a lot of people...
Everyone's going to want to get it done.
That's right.
And I guess the fact that if you can't get the inspector the last couple of weeks, that's your problem, isn't it? It's not the government aren't going to say, well, that's okay.
That's right. There is a little bit of a transitional period for old existing pools, but all of them have to be done by I think it's October next year, October 2021, depending upon the age of the pool. They've got different years, different categories.
The best they get them done quick.
That's right. And what they're looking for when they come, they're looking to make sure that the fences, the barriers are compliant with the regulations. So again, taking our spa on the back veranda, you know, a lot of people have taken some precautions, whether it's keeping the lid on it or putting a bit of a barrier around. What's sensible might not be sufficient. And so at home need to be checking to make sure that what they've put in place actually complies with the requirements. Otherwise, you might be faced with potentially a fine or requirement that you remove the spa or the pool that you have in place.
Yeah, that's a good point. So it's not just necessarily what you think is good enough.
Exactly.
There's obviously regulations that say what it has to be.
That's exactly right.
And the other thing too, I heard of one, this is years ago, where the person did all the pool, they did the fencing and all that sort of jazz, and then the lock broke after about 3 months and they never replaced it. I mean, that can have tragic consequences too, can't it?
Yeah, look, it only takes a moment it can be a tragedy. So the fine that folks are looking at there, it can be an on-spot fine of $330 if they're not registered. It can lead to a fine, a further penalty of up to $1,600.
And I guess it's not the dollars, though, is it? It's the case of that you are putting lives at risk.
Exactly.
Particularly
correct.
Children.
Children.
That's right. Any pool owners out there, even if they didn't think they were a pool owner, who by this definition are now a pool owner, they need to make sure that they're registering with local council. And again, so go to council website. They'll have some information about their requirements and processes. There are forms online, and you can start the ball rolling. You can do the registration before you get the inspection underway.
Well, I guess the other thing too that we need to mention, you're saying that it's even these... pools that the kids have in the backyard that's got the aluminium wall around, isn't it? Like,
that's correct.
They'd be in it too.
That's correct. So from the rules at the moment, relocatable pools, so like the inflatable pools, they don't apply.
Yep. Well, they're generally fairly little, aren't
that's
they?
Right. So yeah. The little kiddie wading pools, they're not affected by this. But yes, anything that's of a semi-permanent nature, the above-ground pools, that, and again, they're not particularly deep, usually a metre, one and a half maybe, they are certainly encapsulated in this.
So if you've got one of those, which we talk about, where they're often a bit of aluminium around and that.
Correct.
So they've got to have fencing with a gate and all that on them, around them too.
They do.
Gee, I don't think everyone realises that.
No. And so this is relatively new, as Aman said. It only came into effect 1 December. But people do need to hop on it.
And I guess the other thing is too, you don't want to be the first person in court either.
No, you really don't.
You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Welcome back to Community Connections on Yarra Valley FM 99.1, the voice of the valley. We're at 17 minutes to 1 and 23 degrees. We're aiming for 28 degrees today, so I think we'll probably make it. We're going to talk about a granny flat in the backyard.
Yeah. As we continue our theme of things you need to apply to councils for permits for, it's a very long list. Please don't consider today exhaustive by any stretch of the imagination. But while you're having to get permits to remove trees and to do this and that, one of the things that often you don't need a planning permit for is to erect a accommodation unit in your backyard for what's called a dependent person. And so commonly these are known as granny flat units, the little semi-portable that you've put in the backyard for Nan to come and live in.
So when you say semi-portable,
yes,
is it not allowed to be on stumps or can it?
No, some of them are fully constructed. Right. It's not so much a description of the construction method as it is the legal status of that building there. And so some people, they build them very beautifully and they can spend a lot of money doing so. And in many situations, it'll depend largely upon the local council. Each council has slightly different rules. Right. But in many situations, you can erect this dwelling without needing a planning permit, which means the rules...
Does it depend on size, do you know? Or?
No, it's not usually dependent upon size.
Right.
It's usually just about having someone live there who's dependent for care and support on the occupants of the property.
Oh, so it's more the person rather than the building.
Exactly. It's quite unusual. Oh, it's quite unusual. And so the most common scenario that you see that is with aged parents or maybe a family member with some particular special needs who has a degree of independence but needs to be close by. And, you can get this building and put it in place without having to apply to council for a planning permit. The trick is, though, that the legality of that unit is dependent upon the occupant of the property being a dependent person. And so if the grandmother dies, the family member moves on, then the eligibility of that unit to remain there also ceases. Then you're really dependent on the rules of that local council. Some councils will require it to be removed entirely. In fact, the property that I live in, it's Shire of Yarra Rangers, and when the previous owners, when Grandma died, they had to have a massive crane lift the unit out of the backyard. They were the rules. In some other jurisdictions, and depending on the rules, you might only need to disable it from use as a residence.
So you couldn't sleep in it or
that's
cook
right.
And all that.
That's right. But it might be used as a little art studio or a playroom for the kids or something like that. Yeah.
You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Now, I've got something for you to take away again. We're back
this
on the family.
This is our favourite part of the program, Alan.
Well, I don't know. We like to challenge you.
Yep.
And they're all questions that our listeners, pardon me, have rung in for, and while we can't talk on particular cases,
no,
we want to know the law behind it.
Yes.
Righto. So we've talked a bit about child support payments, and I'm not having a go at anyone because these are the questions that have been thrown up, mainly because of the interview that we did with Grant before Christmas.
Correct.
Righto. So this time we've got a guy, and he meets a young lady. And when I say young lady, they're all above 21 or 18 or whatever, so there's nothing wrong about it.
Yes.
At a wine bar or a bar, and they have a few dates, and the relationship turns sexual fairly quickly.
Right.
Righto. He doesn't really want to be in this relationship, so he calls it quits. And
sure.
Says, that's fine. We've been out 5 or 6 times. So then about a month later, he gets a phone call to say she's pregnant.
Right.
And you're the father, and you're going to have to keep this child.
Yes.
You know, like financially.
Yep.
Now, I don't know why, and he didn't tell me, but he doesn't believe the child's his.
Right.
Now, he may be just hoping. He could very well
he's
be hoping.
He's got his fingers crossed.
He could very well be hoping that's going to turn. It's not his, but he has quite a few reservations. Now, morally, you can argue one thing. This is not about any morality or anything. This is all about the pure hard legal fact.
Sure.
He says, if it's not my child, I shouldn't have to pay
right.
to keep that child. And that's fine.
Yes.
Now, there are at least 2 or 3 rights in this. He's got some sort of rights
mm-hmm.
because he's being asked to make payments.
Yes.
The lady that's going to be the mother, she's got some rights.
Yeah.
And babies very early get rights.
Yeah.
So he wants to know what rights does he have to make them prove that it's his child. My understanding is, and we may very well be wrong on this, but I think it was Grant said, you can only be made to take, the court will only generally order a DNA test if there's some thought that there's a crime being committed.
Okay.
Now, I don't know if that's true.
Right.
I'm throwing that out there.
Yep.
But this guy wants to know now, how can he, or what rights has he got to make it to be proved that that child is his?
What a great question.
I don't know any answer, and you don't.
We're going to leave that one for next month. Everyone's sitting at home on the edge of their seats. They're going to have to tune in next month, and we'll get some answers on that one.
Yeah, well, I don't know.
Yeah.
And as he said, I will pay if it's my child.
Sure.
But I don't believe it is.
Certainly understand where he's coming from. Yeah.
And can he demand a DNA test? Because what I thought Grant said, and I might be putting words in Grant's mouth here, that generally the courts only order a DNA test if there's some crime being, or there's a chance that a crime's been committed and they need that DNA to prove or disprove. This is not a crime.
Everyone at home, be here same time next month and hear the answer to that scintillating question.
Righto, we've got 6 minutes to go. and instead of playing a song, you're going to tell us about working from home.
Yes.
What sort of situation?
Look, the final aspect here is we talk about when you need a permit from council. What people might not realise is that in some situations, if you want to work from home, you also need a permit from the council. Yeah. Yeah. So now we're not talking about if you've brought something back from the office and you're having to do something at the kitchen table overnight.
Yep.
That's not really the scenario. It's really more about when people are running their businesses from home. And there are times when councils want a bit more information before they'll say that is okay. There are a whole variety of restrictions, and so you can look into them. Again, start with council websites. A great place to start. But when it starts to impact the neighbourhood, so traffic flows, the appearance of the building, there's noise, if you've got chemicals or gases or hazardous materials on the site, they're some of the circumstances in which you might need a permit before you can operate a business.
What about a hairdresser?
Potentially so, if that's affecting traffic in the area, people's parking, if you've got people coming and going, depending on the hours. A common one, which people might not be aware of, is that, generally it's not permitted for vehicles to be serviced or repaired at a residential property without a permit.
True.
Yeah. So if you've got the neighbourhood mechanic, and I use one, he works from home, most of those generally need to get a permit from council to operate their business from their home if it involves, repairing vehicles. Also, if it involves storing a commercial vehicle at the property, and if that exceeds 2 tonnes in capacity, including the trailer, so it's not hard to do.
Yeah.
If you've got some tradies out there who are storing a few of the
These guys that park their semi-trailer at home?
Yeah, that would almost certainly be a situation in which they would need to have a permit to... That would be considered operating their business from that location.
Would it?
Yeah. So these are some of the situations. As we were discussing off air, generally these things only become an issue when neighbours complain. So maybe I'm giving fodder to some neighbours who are listening right now.
neighbours can be terrific, but they can also cause some trouble.
That's right. But again, if you're in doubt, it's worth just running it by council. Yep. Check the website, get some information, and make sure that you're not setting yourself up for failure down the track.
Well, look, we've covered a few things today.
We have.
We've certainly been a bit into this family law, and I'm hoping we might get a little bit of a break from that over the next couple of months. But, look, we're happy to take any sorts of legal questions, and they can either ring us during the week on 59615991, 59615991, or send us an email, info@yarravalleyfm.org.au. Just... don't go into great details about your case, because we can't do that. The solicitors need to talk to you for a lot longer than what we can here. Or we've got a Facebook page. I'm not sure whether Hutchison Legal do, but we have a Facebook page. And you could pose any questions on that. We'd be happy to take it on our Facebook page. And we'll front them up the next time we're here.
The more curly, the better.
Yeah, well, we like to give you a little... The one I found fascinating was the one that we did in December about the child that could have been at the wrong place at the wrong time, because I think that's just something that, just came out of nowhere. And
absolutely.
I suspect there's a case behind that. I think somebody probably is involved in that. But anyway, we're happy to do that. So thank you, guys. Again, I look forward to having you in for the next 11 months or 10 months now. We've done one.
The year is fast going.
And look, it's been a pleasure to have you. And we look forward to seeing you next month.
A delight as always.
Thank you so much. Pleasure.
Thanks.